at the end of the film, you may not feel you know him that much better, but would it be realistic? Would it be plausible to expect that? Wouldn't that be forced, that suddenly you now understood him completely? He is a complete unknown.
He is a complete unknown. So one scene. Hello and welcome to At the Movies with Mike and Marie, a show where two film professors talk about movies. I'm Marie Westhaver.
And I'm Mike Giuliano.
And today we're going to talk about A Complete Unknown and Nosferatu, starting off with the new Bob Dylan biopic. Where do you want to start with this one?
Well, I want to start with where it ends, in effect. And what I mean is this, that as I was leaving a crowded theater, I overheard people saying that was so much better than I thought it would be. And correspondingly, when I read the print reviews of it, a number of reviewers made the same point, that whatever their expectations, the film is so much stronger even than whatever they were expecting or hoping for. And I really think it's an exceptional film. I really think it's very, very strong. To enumerate some of the reasons for that strength, Timothée Chalamet, needless to say, is a major actor, and boy, is he impressive here. It's just an amazing performance. And the fact that he and the other principals do their own playing and singing. I mean, watching the film, and I know these musicians' careers, you know, pretty well, and watching the film, I really felt like there they were, vocally and instrumentally. So that is just like so smart. Marie, let me get your initial responses to it. We could talk probably for 10 hours about this film, but I'll give up the dais at this point and hand you the microphone.
Well, I'll start off by saying I was impressed with what I saw. I went in with some expectations. I'm a Bob Dylan music fan, and I knew a little bit about, you know, what happened at the Newport Folk Festival, and I knew that they were going to dramatize that. I thought Timothée Chalamet really came across like he was Bob Dylan. He was very believable. And the other people in it were just incredible. Edward Norton, I think, was fantastic as Pete Seeger. And Boyd Holbrook, I thought, stole a lot of this. Every scene he was in as Johnny Cash.
Well, you know, speaking of Columbia's own Edward Norton, again, a really gifted actor. I got to say, on first impression, I mean, I've met Pete Seeger a couple times. And so, I know him in the sense of, you know, the physical presence. And he had that, what I call angular quality. He had a rangy, kind of lanky build and so on. Edward Norton, to put it bluntly, has a rather solid physique. And so physically, it's not a very good matchup. However, having made that observation about one of them being angular and the other more solid, it's a more than solid performance. Norton really captures Seeger's performance and outlook and sensibility, if I can put it that way. And so, again, you know, likewise, in terms of, you know, others like, you know, the Jim Baez character and so on, they don't always match up perfectly in a physical sense, but how could they, short of CGI? But they capture the personalities really, really well. Now, the thing I want to pick up on immediately, because I want to hammer this point home a bit. If I had a hammer, I'd hammer this point home, is namely this, that the director, James Mangold, has referred to the film as a fable. And it really is just a remarkable evocation of Greenwich Village in the early 60s, inside Llewyn Davis type material there in terms of the folk music scene. But bear in mind the fable aspect. First of all, when you have a performer like Dylan, after all, it's not even his real name, it's Robert Zimmerman, you know, this Midwestern kid who relocates to the... And in fact, when he starts telling these stories about his early life, the Joan Baez character, I have to keep it rated PG, but she tells him basically he's full of it. What a lot of stuff you're saying, you know. So again, artists in general are known for inventing and reinventing in themselves as much as their work. So the point I want to hammer home is this one, that Dylanologists, those people who sift through Bob Dylan's garbage and so on. And I'm a Dylan freak too. I mean, I've seen him in concert a few times as recently as 2023. He's in his 80s now and still doing really remarkable work on stage. But anyway, the Dylanologists tend to nitpick. And so I'll nitpick just a bit here, only in the sense of pointing out how this is, as you said, Marie, a dramatization. This is taking his life and looking at it through a kind of dramatic lens. And of course, Dylan does similar things in his own work. Anyway, cutting to the chase, Newport, 65. When you read music historians and critics, there's a lot of dispute as to exactly what happened at Newport in 65. The short form version is Dylan had gone electric. this icon of the traditional folk music scene, epitomized by who else but Pete Seeger, you know, there at Newport suddenly is plugging in and the audience is booing, and it's just a fiasco by some estimations. In any event, it's a significant moment in rock music history. That is one of the highlights of the film, but let me point out ways in which the film very freely fictionalizes things. For instance, much of our screen time is spent with Dylan and his first serious New York girlfriend, Susie, who's renamed Sylvie and played by Ellie Fanning. The character is renamed, ironically, at Dylan's insistence in terms of music rights and, you know, his blessing on this. He said, yeah, he was all for it. In fact, he actually did send out a message in social media praising Timothée Chalamet and you know, endorsing the film for treating his life, or at least some version of his life. And by Dylan's standards, it was like a full statement. It was a few sentences, right? He really liked it, the notion of it. Anyway, the girlfriend's character has been renamed, and I guess to partially protect the identity of the real woman, though ironically there, it calls even more attention to the fact that here's her real name and here's the fictional name. But here's the point again at Newport. They had broken up, and in fact, you can see her on an album cover, you know, or early in his career. They had broken up in 1964. I mean, decisively had broken up. She was not at the Newport Folk Festival in 1965. In the film, she is. For dramatic purposes, have the girlfriend travel from New York to Newport to confront her soon-to-be ex-boyfriend. Well, they'd already broken up. Secondly, even though he and Johnny Cash were very close and Cash had been to Newport, Johnny Cash was not at Newport in 1965. In the film, he is, because you also need to have some direct contact there. And a quick footnote, of course, James Mangold had made the film Walk the Line, so he's dealt with Johnny Cash before. A third example I'll cite has to do with what actually happened just off stage. And again, I can't speak definitively this because so many people point fingers in different directions. The short form is that Pete Seeger himself wanted to pull the plug, like literally pull the plug. Some people have disputed that. I won't get into that because we won't get out of it. But as to exactly what happened just off stage there. However, here they emphasize the crowd booing. Now, one of the critical points of dispute is, were they billing because Dylan had gone electric? Because, in fact, he already had some songs out and performances where he was heading in that direction. So was the audience totally surprised at Newport? Or were they billing because he only played three songs initially and then walked off stage? You know, that it was a truncated performance. That's something we can probably never definitively answer. The final point I'll make, and this is where it gets really interesting creatively in terms of how you transpose things for dramatic effect. One of the most famous moments in the film at Newport is somebody in the audience shouting up at the stage, Judas, you know, is, you know, here's Dylan has betrayed the cause of folk music. Now, there was a shout of Judas at a concert, but it was not at Newport in 1965. It was in Manchester, England, around a year later. And it's on tape. You can see it in documentary footage. It's there. But again, I'm saying this not to criticize the film, but simply to point out in terms of the creative process, how this director and creative team freely work with the material. And so it's not, as you watch the film, just bear in mind, it's not a documentary portrait, it's a dramatic portrait of Dylan.
And yet you don't really learn more about Dylan. He's still just as mysterious at the end of the movie as he is at the beginning of the movie. How would you stack this up next to a movie like I'm Not There?
Well, what's interesting, with I'm Not There, where various actors portray Dylan, there it's so obviously dramatized. It's so obviously fictionalized. It's a kind of fantasy. It's an in film, isn't it? But push come to shove situation, like, you know, this is really the major film about Dylan. The other one is a kind of interesting fantasy, and just really clever in various ways. But you know what? If you really want to try to understand Dylan and really immerse yourself in his environment, this film, for obvious reasons in terms of a naturalistic setting, right? You really feel like this is, and that is a quasi-documentary quality of the film. It's exceptional, really. You really feel like you're in Greenwich Village in the early 60s. So it's a matter of, I would call, temperament and preference there as to what do you want. Do you want a sort of like embroidered fantasy, you know, spinning off of Dylan, or do you want a more direct hit on him biographically? In terms of the mystery of Dylan, he still has that quality. I mean, when I saw him just the other year in concert again, he has a really tight young band. He's really still terrific on stage, but there's very little interplay directly with the audience. And, you know, I'm not going to even get into the issue of, can you understand what he's saying? You know, that's a whole other discussion, I guess. But just the fact that there's that enigmatic quality that people oftentimes say is more from the late career, but no, it's always been there. You know, he's always had that enigmatic, so he's self-invented, but also self-obscuring in some ways. As to the extent to which he understands himself, that's one of the most interesting aspects of this film, a complete unknown after all. He might be unknown to himself even. The film spends a lot of time tracking his romantic history there with that girlfriend I've already talked about and with other women. And, you know, that's a case where he's so self-absorbed that oftentimes the women kind of come and go, and he seems to need them, and he's even desperate at times, but other times when he can sort of shrug them off. My favorite film about Dylan, actually partly in that respect, is Don't Look Back, the great documentary about his English tour. Because in that documentary film by Don Pennebaker, Joan Baez goes along on the tour, and she's not really performing. I mean, they often had performed together on stage, as they do in Complete Unknown. But in the film I'm talking about at the moment, that documentary, she's just sort of going along, you know, the way a girlfriend would go along. And she's really sweet and nice and this and that. But there's a scene in the film fairly early on where Dylan's like at the piano, just kind of riffing and noodling and this and that. And she's talking and singing like at the edge of the frame. And he's basically like tuning her out. He's not listening to her. She goes out the door. She like leaves the room and she leaves the film. You never see her again. And that's relatively early in that documentary where she just, and there's no underscoring of that. You just like gradually as a viewer realize, wait, what happened to Joan? Does Dylan even notice at that point? So that's a connection between that actual documentary footage of Joan Baez and Bob Dylan and this film here where it's quite interesting where sometimes he's quite needy and even graspy that, you know, he wants the girlfriend, where is she? Other times where he's perfectly self-absorbed and, you know, his life is totally in his mind like that, and he almost doesn't need the women or just somehow when he needs them, he needs them. And it's not entirely flattering as depictions of Dylan go, but again, the complexity of the man, because at the time he was performing at Newport, not only was Susie, the girlfriend, gone, but he was getting married, and he did, right? So he does have a marital connection that way. So it's a very long-winded way, which is my way of getting back to your question, namely that with Dylan, at the end of the film, you may not feel you know him that much better, but would it be realistic? Would it be plausible to expect that? Wouldn't that be forced, that suddenly you now understood and completely? He is a complete unknown.
He is a complete unknown. So one scene that I remember, and I can't remember which woman it was, says, I think it's Elle Fanning. She gets up to leave because she says, I know that you really want to be by yourself. And he says, part of me, not all of me. And then she walks out. Like there he acknowledges that that's how it is. I did think it was interesting to see the 60s, the clothes, the cars. And, you know, it was sort of hard to believe that there was ever any sort of controversy over a song like This Land Is Your Land. You know, we open up with Pete Seeger defending the song. You know, he's in court over the song. He goes out and sings the song outside on the steps. So you sort of think he's going to be somebody who's going to be ready for protest music and plugging in and all this stuff, but that's not what happens. By the way, Edward Norton was playing Seeger's actual guitar. That must be fun when you get to play a character and then you get to, you know, actually use their instruments and stuff. That just must be amazing.
Well, I know the one time I met Ed Norton, the thing that struck me so much was just his seriousness as an actor. I mean, he's really, really so devoted and it's so intensive that what you're saying is totally in alignment with that, that he would not only be like playing a banjo, but that he would play, you know, Seeger's own instrument, that kind of thing. And the film has that sense of commitment, doesn't it? It really shows you. And in fact, you know, like Timothée Chalamet had spent several years actually preparing for this role. I mean, this wasn't just something they just signed on for and said, hey, let's do it. I mean, these folks really prepped for it. And that kind of attention to detail of performance, of personality, like vocally, it's really uncanny how well Ed Norton gets Seeger's vocal inflections and likewise, you know, but the extent to which he obviously studied the voice, and it's not just like simple mimicry because it gets to the point where you start to embody or, you know, become that person, which for an actor is ideal, right? You're not just pantomiming. You're actually, you know, immersing yourself in becoming that person.
Well, it's gonna be interesting to see what kind of awards this picks up when we get around to that, which is actually gonna be pretty soon. So let's move on to Nosferatu. Now, Mike, I know that you've taught German cinema and you have probably brought up the original. So let's start with German Expressionism and how that shows up in this remake.
Okay, I will spend the next 10 hours discussing that. I have such a strong emotional attachment to this film. As Marie indicates, I teach a German film history course. And yes, a lot of time spent in the 1920s with German Expressionism. And one of the films I use is F.W. Murnau's Nosferatu, the original from 1922 with Max Schreck as the vampire. I still think it's the greatest vampire movie. There are others I like a lot, but that's still the greatest one. And so I come in with that, you know, strong, strong admiration for the Murnau film. And almost as strong, I would almost want to say equally strong, is Werner Herzog's very faithful 1979 remake of Nosferatu. Now, on a personal note, I interviewed Klaus Kinski, who plays the vampire in that, and he was scary on screen and off. So, you know, I have that vivid memories of Klaus Kinski from having interviewed him. And then I've met Werner Herzog a couple times over the years, so I'm like really wedded to that material. And Herzog, interestingly enough, was such a fan of the original film that in his 1979 remake, which is a gorgeous film, he actually shot parts of it on the same locations, same camera angles. I mean, his film was in color, whereas the original's black and white, but he really emulated exact shots at times. That's how close it is. So I have all that love of the material going for me. With this remake now, which has been doing well at the box office, actually, the director, of course, Robert Eggers, is a director you and I have talked about before, and he's got a strong track record based on these few films like The Witch, you know, The Lighthouse, The Northman. This is a director to keep an eye on. What he does with the material here is what I'd call erotic horror, more so than I think in the earlier versions. And I think this film works well enough. I'm not a huge fan of it, but it does work well in various ways. And some people have criticized the film saying, well, it wasn't that scary. And I think they missed the point there. It's not one of the, it does have some jump scares, but it's not a jump scare film. It works more at that creepy, getting into your subconscious level. It, just as in the film, the vampire will first visit, you know, his female victim in her dreams. He infiltrates your mind and then he will enter your room, but he has to be let the right one in. When you invite him in, he can come in. And it's the erotic horror that really is disturbing in a lot of ways and also quite graphic. And that's, again, an indication of the times we're in, that more is shown, if you will, than would have been or even could have been in earlier versions of it. And Bill Skarsgård really is grotesque looking, but he's a grotesque leading man, if you will. He's the principal romantic figure who wants to come into the bedroom. And a lot of the film is really at that sort of what I call icky romantic level. And what's really even creepier is not even so much that he wants to be allowed in, entered in that way, but that the women, specifically the Lily Rose Depp character of Ellen, is intrigued, interested. She already has a man in her life. It's just sort of nice and ordinary and this and that. But who's this, I won't say glamorous, but who's this unusual stranger who wants in? And that's the level at which you have to do some armchair psychoanalysis as the extent to which the women somehow want him. So let me turn it over to a woman and get your perspective at this point. Would you let him in?
I would not let him in. I think they do a great job of making him look, you know, rodent-like and giving the whole film a sense of dread the whole time. There's this underlying feeling of dread. Cinematography is gorgeous, you know, the kind of bluish midnight look, which kind of looks like colorized black and white movies. It looks beautiful. I like Lily Rose Depp in the role as Ellen, but apparently originally it was supposed to be Harry Styles and Anya Taylor-Joy. And I kind of would have liked to have seen them doing this movie.
Well, that's what if casting. And I think the actors we have here are, you know, certainly more than capable. The really great bit of casting actually is Willem Dafoe in here. You know, he plays Von Franz, and, you know, he's sort of this, you know, really intimidating vampire expert, if you will. But the great link there is the film Shadow of the Vampire, which was a feature film, came out around 2000, in which it's about the making of the original Nosferatu in 1922. And there were rumors that, and speaking of rodents, Bill Skarsgård has some rodent-like qualities, but if you really want to see a rodent, watch, and there are a lot of rats running around in this film too, but if you want to really want to see a rodent, watch the 1922 film, because Max Schreck really looks like a rodent. Skarsgård, I wanted to look a little more that way, actually, but in the original one, boy. And so Shadow the Vampire has it's a making of, if you will, on the set of the original Nosferatu, what would it have been like, with rumors that Max Schreck was not only convincing as a vampire, but was a vampire. Let's shoot those scenes at night, not during the day, please. And it's really a very entertaining film. Also, John Malkovich is in it. And in that film, Shadow of the Vampire, Willem Dafoe plays the vampire himself. So it's really a great bit of, I think, casting here, that now he gets to play a vampire expert and killer, if you will. He knows this material. And he is kind of vamping, sorry for the use of the word, he is sort of vamping here in the role, but it's some fun that way. I mean, you have to have a droll sense of humor to some extent with a film like this. And so when he goes to town, it allows for some melodrama here. But no, Maria, I see your point there that, you know, it would be interesting to see how other actors might do in those roles.
Although I did like Willem Dafoe in this. Apparently, he did a scene with 2,000 live rats. That's commitment.
There are some really disturbing scenes with the rats. And you know that, like, they're going to, when he comes in on the ship, there'll be rats running off of it and then through the streets and all. And boy, those were very convincing rats, you know? And so that's commitment on the actor's part, if you're willing to play opposite that many rats.
And it might not seem like a classic horror film, but I thought some of the scenes were really gruesome. I mean, they really go there in terms of gore.
You know what? And here, let me get on the soapbox with this, and maybe too much so. In other words, one of the great things about the original Nosferatu and the Herzog remake is that sense of dread and of what's ominous. And literally the shadow on the wall. Now, this film also does that very effectively, like, you know, this arm stretched out and the tapered fingers. And that's something you find in German Expressionism, you know, any treatment of a vampire in films like that. And this film has that, and it's very effective. But this film also goes there in the sense of, well, it's an R-rated film, and you know what? You're going to get gore. And my feeling is there was, and I don't want to sound puritanical here so much as there was just maybe too much. It just seemed like sometimes it was being explicit in a way that just like was pushing it more than it should. How do you feel about that? Because, you know, again, I'm not being squeamish there so much as just thinking, well, wouldn't it be more effective if you suggested some of this rather than showing it?
Yes, and they showed it several times, which is why I wanted to mention it, because I did think that it was a little over the top for me, too. I mean, I was expecting horror. I wasn't necessarily expecting gore.
Well, that's, I think, playing to audience taste, don't you? Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, sad comment, if you will, that audiences want, because you're right. It would be enough maybe to have one scene where you're just like, well, here it is, you know, straight mm-hmm. on. But it gets repeated a few times. It's like, well, you know, like an encore for your further viewing pleasure.
Like somebody was enjoying themselves. And I actually saw it on Christmas Day. So there was a moment where it kind of threw me out of the movie to think, why am I watching this on Christmas? By the way, it was packed. I had no idea so many people went to the movies on Christmas.
Well, that has been a pleasant surprise, actually. I thought it would do okay, but it really, at the Christmas season, became one of the top Christmas releases. I do have to sort of smile at the notion of you're seeing it on Christmas Day itself. That might merit some further armchair psychoanalysis, but that would take another 10 hours.
Well, my excuse is that my goth daughter really wanted to see it, so we decided to go on Christmas.
And what did she think?
She loved it. She likes the original too, very, very much. By the way, speaking of the exteriors of the castle, they were filmed at a castle. It's a Romanian castle in Transylvania and one of the largest medieval castles in Europe. And it's the castle where Vlad Dracula was briefly imprisoned. So, you know, some of the dread that they got going on in that film just has, you know, classic locations.
And you know what? Speaking of classic locations, almost every version of the film is kind of like weird in the sense of where is this actually taking place. I know they might give you a card saying Transylvania, but oftentimes, and it's in the original film and the remakes and all, you get this mix of, you know, you get these Central European accents, but Germanic, but then you also get British accented voices. And this film, and actually like the original Dracula stories tend to be that way too. It's like some sort of like Never Neverland. Where is this actually taking place? And that actually ironically plays to advantage, doesn't it? There's a sort of dreamlike quality, almost like, where are we? It's sort of a fairy tale, a horrible fairy tale setting, if you will.
I want to mention something that is, I don't know if it's a callback to the original movie or not, but in the original movie, Max Schreck only blinks one time. And in this movie, there's a nighttime scene where Lily Rose Depp walks to the window. Throughout that single uncut camera scene, she doesn't blink. And I just have to assume that people are as nerdy as we are about movies and that it was intentional. What do you think?
I honestly don't know in that case, but this is a very self-conscious filmmaker. I mean, he knows the history of this film. And so I would be inclined to agree with you on that, that's some, you know, like an inside baseball kind of reference. But, you know, if you watch it again, keep your eyes wide open and look for that. But that's where film nerds actually sort of go on overdrive, don't they? Like, how many people watching the movie would even think about that, but then would like think about it for weeks afterwards? But that's us. That's why we're film profs.
That must be the reason. It is interesting that the director, Robert Eggers, actually co-directed a stage production of Nosferatu in high school. Kind of makes me hope he wins some sort of Oscar just to close the loop on that little curlicue.
Well, you know, when you think about it, I mean, you know, most people back then would have been doing Hairspray or something. And here he is doing Nosferatu. That tells you something. You see where that career is headed.
Do you see this movie garnering any, at least nominations?
Yeah, you know, again, this is hazardous for us because we talk before those things are announced. But, you know, certainly I'm expecting they'll be nominated in major categories. Yeah, because it had really strong reviews. And the box office, as we said, was, you know, stronger than expected, actually. So it's firing on all cylinders critically and commercially. So I would think it'd get some awards recognition, at least by way of nomination.
Also, you know, it's an homage to a classic film that all the people voting, I would think, would want to at least give it a shot at something, because it's a decent remake. I know nothing will replace the original, of course. I also thought it was interesting that, you know, cinema is light, and what does in Dracula is light. I didn't know if that metaphor was too tenuous to push, but I'm sure it must have occurred to you.
Yeah, it did actually. And I don't want to, we all know how the story ends, so I don't, but by the same token, don't want to spoil it specifically, but it is really important in a film like this, what happens when, you know, if the vampire is allowed in and then spends the night and then is still there at dawn. So, you know, the light coming through the window, for sure, you know, not only speaks to vampire lore, but speaks to cinematic, not just lore, but essence. You're absolutely right. You know, you're using light to record images. So again, I'm sure that the filmmakers were aware of all that. And thank goodness they don't underscore it too overtly. I think it's better for that to have its effect and then for us to talk about it afterwards.
Actually, isn't silver one of the things that can actually vanquish a vampire? I mean, it is a silver screen.
Well, there's all that as well. And yet somehow vampires seem quite comfortable, quite at home on the silver screen. So I'm not
quite
sure.
Telling us something.
I don't know quite where we should take that.
Well, that does bring us to the end of this episode. But don't forget to check out our other episodes at atmhcc.podbean.com. And we'll see you next time at the movies.
See you then.
Thank you for listening to Dragon Podcast. You can find this episode and all other Howard Community College podcasts available for your listening pleasure on all streaming platforms, as well as Podbean at podbean.com/dragonpodcast. Thank you for listening.